You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 3rd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. How's everyone tonight?
Pretty good.
Couldn't be better. Evan, what is today?
Well, I looked for something a little cheerier than what I actually found. I found something, though. Okay, so 1982, doctors at University of Utah Medical Center removed the respirator of Barney Clark. Do you remember who Barney Clark was?
Yeah, artificial heart.
That's right.
Yeah, that guy on the respirator.
That's right. Oh. The world's first recipient of a permanent artificial heart, the Jarvik 7.
Oh.
And he survived for 112 days on the heart.
Well, that's a little depressing, actually, but also not.
Did they give him the Jarvik 8?
No. That upgrade didn't come out yet. Well, the other one I had was
still
in 1984
beta.
Was the world's worst industrial disaster ever, when 40 tons of poisonous methyl isocyanate gas leaked out of Union Carbide in India.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
500,000 people suffered from acute breathlessness, pain in the eyes, and vomiting.
500,000 people?
Yeah.
I hate when that happens.
Just got more depressing.
So, yeah,
okay.
I was telling you that I didn't have any very serious news today.
You know what else today is?
No.
Today is the day Mobile, Alabama announced that they are going to create and consume the world's largest whoopie pie.
Ooh.
Whoopie.
Whoopie pie. That's
all right.
It's cake.
So
and
what's a whoopie pie?
You don't know what a whoopie pie is?
I know what a whoopie cushion is.
Were you raised in a cage? What? A whoopie pie. It's
Rebecca, at what point did you say you weren't a total dork?
I don't think I ever said that. A whoopie pie is two disc-shaped, let's call them discs of cake, sandwiched around a delicious layer of frosting.
Oh, you call that a whoopie pie?
That's
a moon pie.
Is that called a UFO?
A moon pie.
That's a moon pie.
It's the same thing, a moon pie, a whoopie pie. Go with whichever one you think is funnier.
We have a few news items to get to this week.
All right.
Thanks for the whoopie pie, Rebecca.
No problem.
Thanks for the whoopie.
So scientists have recently revised our image of what the early Earth looked like.
Turns out it was a cube.
Right.
Weird. nobody saw that coming. Sorry.
Four corners of the earth.
The classic, you know, science textbook picture of the early Earth is what they call the Hadean period, from Hades, meaning hell. Yeah, it was basically hot, molten lava everywhere. Turns out the Earth was probably not as hot during that period as was previously thought. The primary reason probably being that the sun was putting out less energy at that time.
About 30%, right?
Yeah, 30%
less energy. That's huge. 30%, that's huge.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
Wow. Definitely.
Now, the new evidence they have to revise their image of the early Earth comes from these naturally occurring zircons.
Yep, zircons. Bits of Earth older than 4 billion years that scientists know have definitely survived that long.
That sounds much more impressive than fake diamond ring.
Yeah, a zirconia.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh.
Nice try.
These are zircons embedded in Australian rocks, and the chemical analysis of these indicates that they formed in a cooler environment than was previously thought, and also, I think, cooler, wetter, and with more loss of heat or more heat radiation at that time. What they think that means is that they formed in a subduction zone. That's where, you know, one plate is diving beneath another one. And if that's true, that means that there were plate tectonics at the time, which is earlier than we thought, which means the crust had essentially already cooled and formed its plates. So this all leads to the conclusion that perhaps the Earth was a lot cooler. It's still warmer than today. I mean, the Earth was still warmer than it would be today, but not the hellishly hot, you know, temperatures that they thought it was at that time.
Now, does this also mean the first stirrings of life also occurred at a much earlier time than was previously thought because of the cooler
Well, absolutely.
Earth.
This opens the door for the early processes that led to the formation of life to have gotten going. You know, they could have started a lot earlier because it obviously had to wait for the Earth to cool sufficiently for, you know, complex molecules to form and be persistent. So this does extend back even further the time period potentially where, you know, the chemical, you know, evolution could have started.
The researchers studied tiny mineral grains trapped inside the zircons between 4 billion and 4.2 billion years ago as they were being formed.
Right. So, the Earth is about 4.5 billion.
Yeah, so we're just talking the first couple hundred million years of the planet, which is
incredible. And the reason why that material is so important, the zircons is so important, is it's so hardy and tough that while other rocks were melting around it, this stuff was just hanging out and not terribly affected by the heat that melted the stuff around it. So that's why they're so old and long-lasting.
Another interesting news item from the last week, this one having to do with turtle evolution. And, yep, we have filled another one of those nasty gaps in the fossil record.
And created two new ones.
Creating two more.
Yeah.
Yeah. But up, well, pump, thank you.
Usually when there's a significant gap in our picture of the connection of different species to each other, you know, what evolved into what when, whenever you find one new fossil in the middle of these huge gaps, it almost always causes more confusion at first than it generates more questions than it answers. You know, so science usually passes through that phase, you know, where early on each new bit of information just generates more questions until a more complete picture starts to emerge. Before this fossil, which is being presented in the journal Nature, and it's a 220 million year old turtle ancestor known as Odontochelys, found in China. This is a turtle that the bones suggest that it only has the bottom half, the abdominal portion of the turtle shell. Does anybody know what that's called?
Nope.
The belly.
Plastron. It's called plastron.
That was my next guess.
The top portion is called the carapace.
I knew that.
So in this, it appears in this specimen that there's only a plastron and no carapace, although the spine is extended, so it's like the beginning of a carapace, but not a complete one.
Does that indicate that it was because the bottom was fleshed out first, so to speak, that it lived in like a three-dimensional liquid environment?
Exactly. So this would suggest, first of all, if this interpretation is correct, then that would mean that the plastron evolved before the carapace, which we didn't know. It was not known if the carapace evolved first, they both evolved together, or the plastron evolved first. So if this is correct, then that would mean the plastron evolved first. And that's exactly right, Bob. If that's true, then this wasn't an animal that crawled around like an alligator with its belly very close to the ground. That suggests that it was aquatic. You know, so it needed protection from below.
It's related to ducks? What?
It also had a full set of teeth. You know, turtles have beaks. They've lost their teeth. So that's another primitive feature, primitive for a turtle, which makes sense. This is also the oldest turtle ancestor found. Now, prior to this specimen, we had the only turtle ancestors we had fully formed shells. So we had no fossil evidence of how turtle shells evolved.
Wow.
You have reptiles and then turtles with fully formed shells. So, of course, you know, this is on the list of every, you know, creationist, you know, website of as a, you know, where we're lacking fossils. You know, like previously it was, oh, there's no fossil evidence for the evolution of whales. But then we found Ambulocetus.
Bats next, right?
You know, bats are still on the list, although we did find that one earlier bat. So these are slowly getting filled in. We've pretty well fleshed out the whales now. For a long time, all we had was Archaeopteryx in terms of connecting dinosaurs to birds. Now we have, you know, dozens of feathered dinosaurs, you know, fleshing out the whole region between dinosaurs and birds. And now this is sort of the first one for turtles. What's good about this is that, you know, this tells us where to look for more, you know, and I think just like the feathered dinosaurs, we're going to start now seeing a lot of specimens from this group, in the sort of 220 million year old or so from this era of turtle ancestors. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of individual species that are not on the main line that eventually led to turtles. So there's going to be lots of other derived characteristics that are, you know, out of the evolutionary line. But it'll be from this group that was transitional, you know, from the reptilian ancestors to modern turtles.
What surprised me about this article, I had always thought and read in various places that the shell, the carapace, and plastron of turtles came from It's actually the rib cage that turned into,
yes,
into those structures. This article surprised me in that I didn't know that there was some contention between whether it actually came directly from the rib cage or somehow was created from the skin, kind of like the thick, tough hide of alligators, and became the, yeah, shell, then fused into the rib cage. So this kind of like puts a nail into that coffin, and it's pretty much pretty confirmed now that they did come directly from the rib cage, the carapace and plastron,
yeah,
which is interesting. I always thought that was very cool.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that was a very minority,
okay,
opinion. It was just that maybe we haven't completely ruled out that dermal plates, you know, which a lot of reptiles in this time had dermal plates, like a lot of the dinosaurs, you know, had the plates, that these fusion of dermal plates might have led to the,
okay,
shell. But that was always a minority opinion, and that the evidence from turtle development, if you look how turtles develop,
yes,
you know, from an embryo, that suggested strongly that not only did the plastron develop first before the carapace, but also that it develops, as you say, from the ribs and the spine. So this supports, you know, what was already the dominant theory, that they do form from an extension of the ribs and spine.
Okay, the article was unclear about that. Okay.
Right, which is always, you know, that's why it always amuses me when cartoons show a turtle coming out of its shell. That would kill it.
Right.
Be impossible. I mean, it's actually connected. It's part of its spinal column, you know.
I mean, it's like their skeleton.
Yes, it is their skeleton.
Right.
It's an extension, it's exactly, of their skeleton.
It's like their exoskeleton.
Yeah.
So, Steve, this type of news, as much as we'd like to think it would have any impact whatsoever, it's not going to ruffle any feathers of ID creationists,
no,
or anything. Like, if anything,
yeah,
they'll just ignore it, right?
No, they don't ignore it. What they do is they find ways of dismissing it. So if you look at like Answers in Genesis and even the Discovery Institute, when these things come up, like Tiktaalik did, you know, the really nice transition between fish and tetrapods, they just look at minutiae until they find something that they could say casts doubt on its implications as a transitional fossil. So, you know, the whale fossils are an absolute slam dunk. Here you have land-based terrestrial mammals and whales. And the creationists said for years, oh, there's no fossils of halfway whales. This is connecting these two groups. Now we have multiple sequences.
Ambulocetus and,
yeah,
others.
Ambulocetus is kind of in the middle, but we have this sequence, like Pachycetus and other ones, of specimens showing the migration of the nose hole to the top of the head, enlarging in size, the shrinking of the hind legs, and the conversion of the tailbone into the horizontal tail fluke of whales. I mean, it's a beautiful evolution.
Is that all you got? Is that all you got?
It's a beautiful evolutionary sequence. And then you read their sites, and they just say, oh, you know, there's only a slight trend for the blowhole to move posteriorly, you know. Okay, what does that mean? they just sort of
brush it aside.
Nitpick, yeah, these details. Yeah, they just brush it aside. It's really, it's pathetic when you read it. But they will, and I'm sure they'll do it with this one. Actually, they already are. There's already a creationist website that, and what they're pointing out is that there is actually another way to interpret this fossil.
Mm.
And which is it's a legitimate alternative interpretation that was also published in Nature. It doesn't, of course, cast doubt on the evolution of turtles. It just means that the particular pathway that it took is always hard to interpret. It's possible that this turtle ancestor had a soft carapace, and that did not fossilize, and that it may have in fact evolved from turtles that already had a fully formed shell. So it may be a derived characteristic rather than an ancestral or primitive characteristic, and which means that this would be a specimen that's out of the main sequence that led to turtles, that basically secondarily lost or its carapace, or it became a soft sort of structure. And they point out that some of the seaborne turtles, actually modern turtles, have that kind of structure today. Okay, that's what I mean. One fossil like this, yes, there is this sort of more straightforward interpretation, but there's always multiple ways to interpret one fossil. We're going to need more specimens from this same time period to really nail down. Because, you know, evolution's a complex branching bush. It's not a ladder. It's not a linear sequence. There's no purpose or direction to it. It's just things sort of evolving in multiple different morphological, you know, anatomical directions. We only know where they're heading because we have the benefit of hindsight. We know we're 220 million years later. We know what its descendants are, or the descendants of its close relatives look like. You know, this will go the way that the birds did. You know, this is like the Archaeopteryx of the turtles, right? But eventually there's going to be tons of specimens, and then they'll just deny it all. They'll just you do what they're doing right now for bird evolution and whale evolution and human evolution and mammal evolution is just, make ridiculous arguments to deny the obvious big picture transformation over time connecting these, major groups.
It'll still be turtles all the way down for them.
That's right.
Good one. Didn't see that coming.
That's absolutely right.
Turtle down design.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, China.
Yeah, lots of really great fossil beds in China.
Imagine that sad day in the far future when we find the last fossil ever.
Well, we won't know, Bob. We'll never know that.
Sure we will. When we have quintillions of nanites scouring the entire Earth down a few miles, and they found the last one.
Yeah.
There it is.
Assuming they haven't rebelled against humanity by then.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
that,
even your nice description there makes it sound scary.
Yeah, right.
I imagine them feasting on our bones to make their own fossils.
I can't wait.
Must find fossils. Must destroy humans.
Bob, an alternative is that we don't actually have to dig them out of the ground. We just image the fossils in situ the ground and piece them together with a computer.
Steve, you don't
obvious.
Get it. Bob has already thought about all this. He's already mapped it out.
At night dreaming
but, so it's
this.
Actually it's actually possible that we may survey the entire Earth down to a couple of miles.
Absolutely.
And pick out every bit of fossil everything and piece it all together and have a complete fossil record. To the extent that it exists.
And all those spaceships and embedded in the crust of the Earth.
Can those nanites find me a girlfriend?
Steve, imagine you wake up, you go to your computer, it's like, oh yeah, the nanites found. Here's 5 million new fossils we found. You can look at.
You wouldn't have to go to your computer. The nanites would bring you your computer.
Or a girlfriend.
They would build you an exact duplicate of the fossil right in front of you. You'd print it out.
Yes.
3D printer.
It would be in the cloud. It'd be in the cloud. And your brain would be wirelessly jacked into the cloud of information. So it would just
and
be
TV
there.
And TV would just play endless reruns of Star Trek all day long.
Too bad we're going to be the last generation of people to die off. And the next generation will find the cure for death. And
death.
Yeah, that's,
they'll
that's
be,
my
they'll
big fear.
They'll be the ones to reap all the rewards.
That's my big fear.
And a girlfriend.
But I'm still waiting for the aliens to come down and to give us their holographic high-definition images of the Earth that they've been collecting for the last few billion years.
Yes.
I'm still waiting for Massachusetts to legalize beer delivery.
Come on, one miracle at a time here.
I set my sights on the realistic.
Right.
Steve, we won't have to wait for the aliens. We'll just find that cloaked satellite and hack it and find out what's recorded for the past few billion years. Okay, enough of that.
Enough of the serious stuff.
So there is a group of scientists who are planning an expedition into the remote swamps of Arkansas looking for an elusive creature that the scientific mainstream believes probably doesn't exist.
Bigfoot.
Do you guys know what they're looking for?
Nope.
I bet it's something.
Chupacabra. Chupacabra.
I bet it's not something cool like chupacabras.
Psychic
ivory-billed woodpecker.
Oh, yeah.
I knew it.
Remember that?
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Bunch of bird lovers.
This is a beautiful woodpecker.
He doesn't exist because Bigfoot ate him.
that was believed to have gone extinct about 70 years ago. The last known sighting in the U.S. was in 1938, but there was sightings in Cuba up to about 1948. But about 4 years ago, there have been a number of possible sightings in northwestern Florida and in Arkansas, and again in the remote swamps.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a couple, there's like one video and a couple of pictures, but not of sufficient detail to distinguish the ivory billed from the pileated woodpecker, which is its closest relative, and it looks almost exactly like it, except the ivory billed is a little bit bigger. There are also some differences in the white and black color patterns on its wings and underside. And it has an ivory bill. But other than that, it's very almost identical, to the pileated woodpecker. So it's fun because it's this real scientific legitimate controversy over whether or not this creature still exists, is still alive. And it's easy to see a lot of parallels with cryptozoology. Except both sides are, being reasonable and scientific and agree that we need to have definitive evidence. We need to actually find one of these things, physical evidence of it, or indisputable photographic or video evidence of it. Which, lacking that, we will not conclude that it exists. We will not accept these fleeting eyewitness testimony and blurry pictures as sufficient evidence. So it was just kind of neat to see that. Plus, it would be damn cool if they still existed, because it'd mean they weren't extinct.
That's right.
Steve, were you expecting any of us to say anything right here?
You know what I love? Ivory bills.
Yeah.
I like green bills.
How can that make me money?
I'm so glad that maybe it's not just that other bird that looks exactly like it. It might be something else.
Yeah, right.
Awesome.
It's slightly bigger, weren't you?
Hey,
listening?
Listen, an anonymous donor has pledged $50,000 to anyone who leads this scientific team to a live ivory bill. So that's how you could make money off of it, Jay. $50,000. If you got a picture of the thing, I'm sure you could sell it to National Geographic for more than that, even.
So if there's one, there's got to be more. There's got to be two.
Yes.
Can I do that from my couch, or do I have to actually go somewhere?
If you can Photoshop something.
Yeah, let's Photoshop it. Steve, send me a picture of a pileated pecker and we'll change it.
Yes, send him a picture of your pecker so that he can Photoshop it in an interesting way.
Are there any old stuffed, taxidermed ivory-billed woodpeckers out there?
There's also recordings of what it sounds like. It has a really bizarre sound.
So could you extract some DNA from the stuffed ones that we've got and make some new ones?
Oh, good one.
80 years?
I don't know.
You mean like Jurassic Park, only boring.
Steve, wait. Steve.
Woodpecker Park.
They're trying to do that with the Tasmanian devil. They might be able to do it. I don't know.
Awesome.
Steve.
Yeah.
I happen to have a recording of that bird, if you want me to play it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, play it, please.
Cool.
It sounds like a Bigfoot recording.
It's got a big, bill, right? It's got
sounds sexy.
It's got a lisp.
Listen to this. Listen to this.
No shit.
What?
That's freaky.
That sounded like my mom yelling to me from downstairs.
No, I think you said I buried Paul.
And for those listeners who are just joining us, yes, Jay lives with his mom.
Steve, play that again. Play that again.
That's weird.
Yeah, wow. That's like my mom going,
Jay, get down here, take out the garbage, and take a pee.
Right. Isn't that neat?
That's awesome. That is so bizarre. How cool they had. That's pretty distinctive. Cool.
Now you're interested.
it literally sounds like a guy making fun.
That's pareidolia.
Yeah, that whole bird sound CD that you have, it's just one guy sitting there making ridiculous recordings for over an hour. Yeah, then there's the black-billed snappy dick.
Kill me,
you know.
Some birds
sound like Donald Duck.
Actually, incredible. That's what I'm getting Steve for Christmas is a CD of me doing bird calls.
Awesome.
Go ahead, give us a Rebecca bird call.
All right, what bird is this? What bird is this?
Oh, that's a snaggletooth lamp lover.
That's a red-breasted elf bang.
That's a blue-bearded glass scratcher.
Bob, my God, how much more setup would you need? Bob, you have to say something.
Come on, Bob.
Come on, Bob. Think on your feet.
I'm not standing. A dodo.
Give us...
Oh, you're
a dodo.
Yes. Yes.
That was a bald eagle.
No.
Are we going to...
Well, one more.
Thing
my favorite one. My favorite one. Ready? Yeah. What's this? That was Jay. I'm going to give you a real bird.
That's Jay.
Ready?
Dark-haired Jay.
This is a cool one. This is a cool one. Ready? Right.
Barn owl.
That was a Battlestar Galactica.
West Virginia barn owl.
That was obviously a dead owl's ghost.
A loon.
Oh, good, Bob. That's a common loon.
Nailed it.
We deal with those so often, you'd think we'd know them.
That always reminds me of Lord of the Rings, too.
Or the Star Trek transporter.
Yeah.
That's cool.
All right, one more quick news item. Bob, you're going to tell us about cell phones that never need to be charged.
Yeah, pretty cool stuff. Have you guys ever heard of power harvesting?
No.
I think you'll be hearing a lot about this in the future. This is a fascinating area of research that's going on. Nanotechnologist Tahir Kagan is a professor of chemical engineering at
Texas A&M University. He published an article recently about a breakthrough that he made that could potentially lead to cell phones with no conventional batteries powering themselves using energy harvested from sound alone. His breakthrough involves piezoelectrics, which are a class of materials that are usually crystals and ceramics that generate a voltage when they experience some sort of mechanical stress, like if you stretch them or bend them or twist them, which is pretty cool. But this effect has been around for quite some time. This is nothing new. And the French discovered this in the 1880s. The first application actually was used in World War I with devices for sonar. Today, you see them every day. They're in quartz watches, they're in microphones, and they're even in car cigarette lighters, which surprised me a bit. Do they even make those anymore? I haven't seen a cigarette lighter in a car, probably in Europe and Japan.
At least for American cars, yeah.
Well, the jacks are there. I don't know if they still give you the lighter itself. You know, power your phones
jack,
and what?
Right.
Yeah.
There's even a nightclub in Europe. Get this, guys. There's a nightclub in Europe that's got piezoelectrics under the dance floor. They use it for power generation for people walking and dancing for, like, I don't know, the lights and stuff. I thought that was
that
pretty
really cool looking.
Interesting application. There's a problem with these, though.
Bob, one quick aside. The piezoelectric effect, by the way, is how bones reshape themselves. It's like when you get braces that move the teeth inside your jaw. The jaw reforms around the pressure.
Oh, interesting.
Piezoelectric effects. Yeah,
really?
It's one of those things. It's one of those sources of electricity that people aren't aware of. It's kind of an exotic or obscure thing, but it is in a lot of stuff. It's cool.
Hmm. Oh, and that's weird because I only thought it appeared in crystals and ceramics, but bone as well. I wonder if you can consider bone a type of ceramic.
And remember we had, I think it was a science or fiction, where using rain to generate electricity through the piezoelectric effect from the rain spattering on
I remember that.
Material.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's cool.
But there is a problem, though. They're a bit impractical. They produce a nice amount of voltage or pure electric charge, but there's not much current there. Now, that's the directed charge that power devices depend on, and that's always been a bit of a problem. But what Kagan did was he discovered a specific performance sweet spot for a piezoelectric ceramic. As he says, we have demonstrated that when you go to a particular length scale between 20 and 23 nanometers, you actually improve the energy harvesting capacity by 100%. So at this specific length, which is very, very tiny, they're twice as efficient. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So this it's pretty tiny. It's very tiny, but it's interesting that at this one size, if it's a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, bam, the performance drops. So I guess the idea here is that if you'd have like thousands of these tiny buggers in your cell phone, all the harvesting energy from the sound that you make, or perhaps it can draw energy from ambient sound, I'm not sure, and then this would be transferred to the cell phone's battery, which would then be used to run the device. And there's lots of applications that you could imagine for this, using the tiny pressure changes or even minuscule body movements to power drug delivery devices, sensors in our bodies. And so I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Or how about this? You could use, like we talked about, the difficulty of charging up an artificial heart or something implanted in your body like that. You could just use the movement of you breathing, for example.
The diaphragm, but it never stops. Absolutely.
To generate energy,
cool.
Lastly here, one of the take-homes I have for this, I feel strongly about, is this is a great example of how little we know about the nanoscale and how beneficial nanotechnology research is proving to be. And just basic research, to me, is just so important because you never know what you're going to find. And who could have anticipated that you double the piezoelectric effect when you get to like 21 nanometers for this specific type of ceramic? The type of thing you really can't predict, and how beneficial just regular basic research, is proving to be and has proved to be in the past.
Yeah, totally cool.
I'd just like to mention that the listeners who are playing the Skeptic's Guide drinking game at home, that was a drink for every time Bob says nano and Steve talks about birds.
Oh, God.
So
a lot of drunk listeners.
This is a bad episode for the game, then.
Yeah. Switch to soda, guys.
Right. Well, let's go on to some of your questions and emails. The first question, actually, I got from the message board. This one was posted by Eric Harris, who writes, Stephen mentioned that for the mammoth DNA sequencing, scientists must have found intact follicles because that's where the DNA is. A few hours earlier, I had been listening to the NPR On Science podcast where someone involved in the research was interviewed. He said something like, unlike what shows like CSI claim, you don't need the follicles to get DNA. We use the shafts of the hair. CSI, of course, is crime scene investigations. That's the popular, actually, it's a very popular science show on TV. So I'd never heard that before, so I did some digging. And it turns out he's right.
Really?
Yeah. It used to be believed that you needed the follicle in order to get the DNA. That's where you get intact cells. And you can get the DNA from the nucleus of those cells. And that the hair is really dense protein.
Keratin?
It's keratin, yeah. There's very small amount of DNA still left. You know, it's basically cells that have been completely turned into this dense protein.
There's PCR? PCR to amplify it?
Well, they didn't discuss that. No, but I'm not sure. They came up with some method 4 years ago. So, in 2004, to extract the DNA from hair shafts. So even though there's a much smaller amount of DNA, it turns out that the keratin is a great way to preserve it. So the DNA is what DNA there is much more intact. It's also hydrophobic, so there's no water penetrates into the hair follicle. Into the hair shaft. So
they probably still use the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, to amplify what little is there anyway. Still,
yes,
but,
yeah, probably. They didn't go into the details of the technique that they're using. So it's a good trade-off. So yes, there's less amount of DNA, but what is there is highly preserved, and this is actually extending our ability to get intact DNA. Or viable DNA farther into the past. They've been able to do this with hair that's 50,000 years old. And that's what they used for the mammoth, when they sequenced the mammoth DNA. It also, interestingly, and this makes a lot of sense, is that there's a lot of mitochondrial DNA in the hair shaft, because I guess you end up with a lot more. Mitochondria are tiny. They're like the tiny little energy factory inside of cells, and there are a lot of them inside each cell. So you end up with a lot of mitochondrial DNA and much less nuclear DNA. But and this mammoth sequencing, they did focus a lot on the mitochondrial DNA, because that is a good way to tell how much biodiversity there is within a population.
Do we have any Neanderthal hair?
I don't know. Hair? That's a good question. And we have...
I don't know. Jay, have you shaved today?
Some DNA from their bones.
Cro-Magnon, not Neanderthal.
Oh.
So I did not know that. I didn't know you can get DNA from the hair shaft. But and so that's just an outdated notion. It's not like it was wrong. It was correct up to about 4 years ago when they figured out how to do it. You know, now we can...
I didn't get the memo.
DNA from here. Yeah, I didn't get the memo either. But so thanks, Eric, for pointing that out to us.
Very good.
The next email comes from Drew Spencer from Tucson, Arizona. And I did pronounce Tucson correctly that time. And he writes, "Hey guys, my partner works at Whole Foods. She buys into a lot of the dubious stuff they sell there. But the other day she ran into something that was too much even for her. Thought you might find it interesting. It's water. They write positive messages on the bottle, which gets infused into the water through quantum mechanics. It results in your body being filled with the positive energy. That's science." Well, thanks, Drew. So this is Aqua Mantra.
Dog, this stuff totally kills me. This is really the height. This is it. You guys ready? Hot off the presses. Brand new. Doesn't get dumber than this.
This is not, sadly, brand new at all. I hate to break it to you, but Masaru Emoto has been doing this crap for far too long and getting away with it. And it got a big resurgence because he was on What the Bleep Do We Know?
Right.
Oh, gosh.
The guy's just a total freakazoid. Like...
The product is brand new, though. This product is brand new.
The brand name is the Aqua Mantra.
The brand name. The research and the basic pseudoscience behind it is not. And Emoto put together some very well-known studies where he did exactly this. He wrote, like, love and taped it to a glass of water. He wrote hate or war or something and put it on another one, and then photographed the resulting crystals that formed, aka ice crystals, and found that the love crystals were pretty and the hate crystals were ugly.
Yeah. That sounds very quantifiable and objective.
Yeah, using that scientific study, he found that classical music, water likes classical music, but hates death metal, apparently. Yeah.
Of course. Here's a paragraph from the website, the Aquamantra website, that this kind of sums it up. So they're talking, they just listed the four statements that they have written on the outside of their bottles of water. Like, so each one would have a different statement. The four statements are, I am grateful, and each one of these are trademarked, by the way.
I am gullible.
I am grateful, I am healthy, I am loved, or I am lucky. And then the paragraph reads, the thoughts inherent in those words permeate the liquid, influencing the taste and beneficial properties of the water. If you are drinking I am healthy, for example, you will resonate with the energy to be healthy. I am loved will encourage you to feel loved, and I am lucky will encourage you to feel gratitude for your life and how you want to be lucky.
How about I am thirsty?
Yeah, I am gullible. They just need to have. Yeah, it also says from, like, what is Aquamantra? It talks about how he showed us the basic principles of quantum theory, whereby the molecular structure of water was changed by a Zen Buddhist monk's thought.
Aha.
There we go. Well, got the word quantum in there. And they do specifically reference what the bleep do we know.
Yeah.
Our purpose in creating this water is to raise consciousness in humanity one sip at a time.
And raise money.
So drink yourself into being healthy, loved, or lucky, and with every conscious sip, say, I am grateful, and well up with the vibrational feeling of gratitude.
What they really mean, of course, is our purpose in creating this water is to bilk lots of gullible idiots out of as much money as we possibly can. That's what they that's what they meant to write.
I'm going to go to Whole Foods tomorrow and try to find some of this crap. I want to scientifically test it and see what happens.
This is about as close as you get to pure magic as you can. I mean, it might as well be
lame.
Homeopathy. Yeah, it's pretty lame.
Well, and Whole Foods sells that too, so.
I wonder what it costs a bottle.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't say on the website. I'll check it out and report back.
Yeah, okay. Do that.
I'm sure it's
Also pick up some of that chocolate with the cayenne pepper in it, because that's delicious.
I mean, bottled water itself is like a pseudo-scam,
you know. Right.
The amount
it's
of money
true.
That they charge for it. But it's tap water.
Well, it's not always tap water, but it often is tap water.
It often is. It's often no different than quality from the water that you can get from the tap. It's funny, in those studies, the New York City tap water always comes out on top of all of even the fanciest bottled waters.
Yeah, because
New York City has really good water.
And the EPA is very strict on what is allowed in your tap water, but does not regulate bottled water. The FDA regulates that and has much more lax requirements.
Yeah,
I wonder how well NASA's urine water would fare.
I heard that broke. Did they get it working again?
Oh, I'm picturing like urine everywhere.
No, I mean just the machine just wasn't working.
Wasn't working.
Like the container broke. I mean just the machine was...
Okay.
The preliminary... Oh, crap, but I don't know what the final word on that was.
I have an update for you, Steve. The urine to water system on the space station is up and running again. As of November 27th. So
fantastic.
They're using it. They are collecting their samples. They'll be sent back to Earth for final analyses. Then they'll be toasting.
Excellent.
Yeah, they switched the machine from suck to blow.
Is that what it was?
Here's your problem.
So there you go.
Well, thanks, Drew. That was good for a laugh. The next one comes from Justin Spicer from Indiana, and Justin writes, I suddenly find myself leading the creation of a skeptical society at my university, but I've never been in one before, nor do I know anyone who ever has. What does a skeptical society do at their meetings?
Drink, mostly.
Doubt even more.
Doubt things. Shake your fist in the air and go, there ought to be a law.
Or we sit around and rub our chins and nod thoughtfully a lot.
You should definitely grow a beard.
Pick up girls.
Yeah,
scam for chicks.
We've had people come to our meetings saying they came here looking to pick up women. That's no joke.
But honestly, you know, to really answer his question,
we're getting there.
It's a very good question because
way.
There are a lot of skeptical organizations popping up, and there's you know, I just got a message from someone that started a Skeptics in the Pub in Flagstaff in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, what do you do? What do you talk about? Like, do you, you know, you can't instantly start pulling in any big names or whatever to give lectures, but you can you can have lectures done. You can find people, the people that you're organizing it with in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, you get three or four people to each do a lecture once a week, or even read something that someone else wrote. You know, you could pull something off of the Nest site, read one of our articles, or read a blog entry.
You could sit around, listen to the SGU.
Well, a good place to find lecturers is at local universities. Professors, have them come right in and talk about science and so forth. That's how that we certainly did that with success.
To get started these days, though, is even easier than that. All you need, depending on who you want to reach, all you need to do is pick a place. It could be a bar or it could be a coffee house, and send out word. Send me an email so I can put it on the Skeptic calendar, which gets a lot of traffic. Let us know at the SGU. Send it around to other blogs, other skeptical blogs. Post it on forums. Say, you know, this is my area. I want to get together with some people. And then at the allotted time, meet up. And if you get a good group and you're all getting along well, you don't even have to really have a speaker or anything. Maybe you can come with a basic topic in case conversation dries up. But at first, just try meeting up with local skeptics and see how that goes.
Yeah.
Do it once a month or once every other week or once a week, depending. And once you've got a good group, then you can start looking at, for instance, you could do a Drinking Skeptically thing where you could go to drinkingskeptically.org and sign up as a group there. They'll publicize your event. You could make it a Skeptics in the Pub sort of thing and have a speaker come out every month like we do in Boston. And that for me was just a matter of sending out emails to everybody I could think of who was local to the area, and also keeping an eye on people who are doing book tours or anything like that. You'd be surprised at how amenable people will be to stopping by and giving a talk or just coming to hang out. You could have like an extended Q&A session with somebody doing a book tour or something like that. So it's pretty easy to get started like that. Oh, and definitely, you know, start up a Facebook group. That's totally free. You can start up a meetup group at meetup.com, and that costs money, but I know that it's worked well for other groups like the Houston Skeptics group. Publish it on the JREF forum. You know, the nice thing about the internet is that you can get the word out really easily and get a nice comfortable group going without actually spending a lot of money or, you know, printing off newsletters or anything like that. Like, you know, you
that's
old
school. Yeah,
to
do. Newsletters is old school. I would definitely start with the things that are easiest to do. That's not going to cost any money, and will have a small investment in time. So, as Rebecca said, one model is just some kind of social gathering, and it's you know, if you get a bunch of skeptics in a room, you'll have stuff to talk about. It's not difficult to see that. Or you could have a meeting based upon a lecture. Now, if this is at a university, also remember universities typically will have a fund to pay for speakers for official university student groups. So you actually will, if you're an official student group, you probably will have access to money to actually pay for speakers, you know, to come in. So that's another source of stuff that you could do.
And you can usually also get money to set up booths and things like that at student orientations, right, and fairs and things like that.
And at the very least, you can, the school typically will provide you a space to have your meetings. Maybe, you know, it could be one of the classrooms or whatever. And also, don't forget, you should, if they have a radio station, have, you know, go to the radio station and see if they'll be willing to do like a commercial for the new group, like, mm-hmm, so people will hear about you quicker.
What one university group did is they had an AV room that had internet access, and they actually Skyped me in for a virtual lecture, which I did for my living room. You know, so that's something you could look into too. If you have the access to, you know, the university's resources, you might be able to do something like that. Now, going beyond just having meetings, you could also then get into the question of, well, what about activist skepticism? You know, what do you want? You know, you might want to just go beyond the meeting phase and become an actual skeptical group that does stuff. And that's gotten a lot easier in the last few years too, because of the internet and Web 2.0, and because there's a little bit more of an infrastructure. The truth is, there really isn't any organized skeptical movement in terms of, there's nothing to be a chapter of, really. There's no real hierarchy that you plug into. It's just something that just never...
Well, except for the Secular Student Coalition and groups like that. If you really want to, you can join up.
there are university groups that are,
yeah.
But you're still these independent university groups that are following a format, you know, that exists. Like I know, like CSI has their Free Thought Student Alliance or Campus Alliance, Free Thought Campus Alliance. Also, you could look into that. But those are both, I think, heavy on the humanism, and they're not pure skepticism,
yeah.
Which may or may not matter to you. One more email. This one comes from David Wiley from the USA. And he writes, I'm a huge fan of the show and all the places it has led me, such as Skeptic and Bad Astronomy. Thanks for providing such high-quality information and entertainment. I have heard discussed frequently on your show how the preponderance of science leads us to believe that global warming is real, is caused by humans, and will cause great hardship to most life forms on this planet, including humans. Yet also on your show I hear mention of trips with some excitement to various places in the world, including now Australia. As you also know, airliners are a tremendous source of greenhouse gases, which most likely includes the water vapor they emit when at altitude. So, what is the personal responsibility of people who recognize this threat to our ecosystem? Aren't we who recognize the dangers of global warming ethically obligated to curtail our own carbon footprints? I would think that highly optional energy uses such as intercontinental pleasure travel would be an excellent place to start. Well, I partly included this one because we did discuss global warming recently, a couple of weeks ago, where I said, you know, even though I think that there, you know, our sort of opinion on this show is that there is a scientific consensus that's pretty solid that there is man-made global warming, and that while there is some legitimate dissent from the consensus opinion within the scientific community, there is this sort of subculture of what I think is global warming denial. But there's also, I think, people who overreact on the other side. Whenever you politicize any scientific issue, there's always the, you know, the potential for irrationality on both sides. In my opinion, refusing to fly, you know, jets across the country or intercontinental travel is an overreaction to the current situation. What I would say is that the far better thing for us to do, rather than to, you know, stop living our lives, you know, and significantly reduce our quality of life or slow down our economy, et cetera. I mean, if your approach to reducing global warming requires those level of sacrifices, it's just not going to happen. I think it's far better to focus on things where through some improvement in efficiency or technology, you know, or focusing our efforts in certain directions, we can have our cake and eat it too, right? If you can have more for less, that's something that people will do. You have to make it economically feasible to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just saying, oh, we have to stop, we can't fly to Australia, you know, because of the greenhouse gases, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. The thing to work on, I think, is just for every person to take a look at their own footprint and figure out the best way for you to, you know, make small adjustments to help. I think if some people want to refuse to travel internationally, that's great. That can definitely help. I don't own a car and never have. And therefore, I think I'm entitled to the occasional trip on an airplane, so it doesn't really bother me that much.
Right. I do own a car, and I'm still going to take plane travel when I need to. But you know what? I think that it's all balance. I mean, I think I do think that people should think twice between flying their private jet all around the world, you know, at the drop of a hat. You know, that's something where I think maybe you can look at that a little bit closer. Like in the United States,
like Al Gore.
Yeah, there was the recent flap over the CEOs of the big automakers through their individual private, you know, corporate jets to the Congress in order to beg them for bailout money. That was sort of bad form, you know. But you know, cramming onto a commercial airliner, huh, you know, with, you know, 200 other people, I think, you know, you got to live your lives. I mean, we can't shut down civilization, you know, at this stage.
Right.
Well, and, you know, it is fair to note that the emissions produced by air travel are really, it's a lot right now.
Yeah.
It's a huge amount. Air travel is a tremendous area for improvement, and I think that there are a lot of people working on how to improve it, and hopefully they will soon.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the first solar-powered aircraft.
Yeah.
The
sun's right there.
I know this sounds selfish, but, you know, I am going absolutely to Australia.
You selfish bastard.
No, nothing is stopping me. I'm going and that's it.
Maybe we should plant a tree and make everybody happy.
Take a boat.
Plus, it's not purely intercontinental pleasure travel. I mean, we got a serious skeptical agenda and, you know, and drinking to do, you know.
That's true.
That's true. We got, you know, we're trying to save the world here. Come on.
Right.
We can plant a koala bear when we get there.
But he says here in his message, aren't we who recognize the dangers of global warming ethically obligated to curtail our own carbon footprints? Well, okay. I mean, but even if we do that, are we really doing it? Are we really helping? Are we making a dent, or is it just a drop of water in an ocean?
I think it depends. Like, if everybody in the United States, you know, cut out one flight a year, maybe it would make a huge impact. But if everybody said, well, just me doing something isn't going to help, then, you know, it wouldn't. It's just kind of like voting.
I think what it really boils down to is there has to be global changes. You know, we have to switch to electric cars or some type of more efficient cars and everything. You know, a group of people not going on any vacations for the rest of their lives, I don't think is going to make that big of a difference. I mean, if everybody stopped using air travel, then the airlines would go out of business, and that's not good for the economy either.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, if you do huge things like that, there are downstream effects that then becomes harder to calculate the net effect of what you're doing. You know what I mean? Doing things like really curtailing airline travel can have a lot of unforeseen consequences.
Yeah, like not delivering all those food shipments to Africa, so people starve.
Or just what are people doing when they're not doing whatever they would have been doing when they were doing airline travel?
More driving.
Maybe you end up doing more
trains.
Driving, which can more than offset it. Who knows? The thing is, it's also, again, my big point is that it's just unrealistic to make a huge impact by demanding or expecting of people that they're going to make these huge personal sacrifices. That's not the way we're going to save the world, if you will. The way we're going to have a huge impact is by making it easy and advantageous to have a low carbon footprint. You know, like, although these are problematic because they have mercury in them, you know, the compact fluorescent light bulbs are actually cost effective. You save money when you use them, and they use a lot less electricity. Their LEDs are coming down the pike, right? When you could screw in an LED light that uses, you know, a 20th or something of the electricity as an incandescent light bulb and lasts a lot longer and will save you a lot of money, then everybody will do it. And then we'll save a lot of electricity and a lot of energy that way. You know, when it becomes cheaper to drive an electric car than a gasoline car, people will do it.
Or when we run out of gas and we're forced.
Well, yes, of course. Eventually that will happen. Eventually we'll get to the point where it will be cost effective. And that's then and only then will it actually happen.
Or you'll all come around to my point of view and bicycle everywhere.
Now, David,
it's not practical.
Back to this point, though, of ethically obligated. I mean, having children is adding a carbon footprint under the earth. Is David perhaps suggesting that we should stop procreating?
I'll suggest.
Well, you can take it to any ridiculous extreme.
Yeah, I guess that's. You know, I guess that's my point. Is that, you know, where are the lines? Where are the boundaries? And how do you, you know, where do you where do you stop? Where do you begin? It's very difficult.
Yeah. I think
put an ethical tag on it. Just, you know, I don't know that that really helps at all.
I think it's an interesting point he brings up. I mean, you know, it could, you know, we don't know exactly what he was implying. I think he's just asking the question, you know, what's reasonable?
Yeah, I think so. And on the topic, for those of you who do want to support airlines that are making strides to produce more fuel-efficient airlines and to just in general be greener, Fortune magazine listed the top companies that were going green, and among them they included Continental for inside the U.S. and Virgin for overseas.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, a lot depends on. I mean, the newer jet engines are a lot more fuel efficient than the older ones. So, how modernized is the fleet? Probably has more of an effect, you know, than anything else.
Yeah,
makes a huge difference. And also, just, you know, how many connecting flights that you have to make makes a big difference. It's obviously efficient to take a direct flight than a lot of connecting flights.
That's true. Taking off and landing takes the most fuel.
How full the flight is.
That's right.
I would think.
Also, airlines could be much more efficient just by the way that the air traffic controllers route them. And airlines have found that you, if you take a certain approach upon landing where you have a slower descent, that can save a lot of fuel as well. So these are, you know, win-win scenarios where it's no inconvenience to anybody. It's just doing using a more efficient system to get significant improvements out of air travel fuel efficiency. You know, certainly I think that if companies can have a virtual meeting rather than flying people all over the world or the country, they should do that whenever they can. I mean, that's a win-win because it's actually efficient, you know, for the company to do that, and it's cost-effective, mm-hmm. it's time-effective, and it also, you know, reduces the carbon footprint of the company's activities. So that's where I think we need to focus on, or where are the win-wins? Let's do those because that's the ones that I think are going to have the hugest impact. Let's do a quick name that logical fallacy. This one is from my favorite gullible website, Evolution News and Reviews from the Discovery Institute.
Oh, God.
This one is from, this is written by my favorite creationist neurosurgeon, Dr. Michael Egnor. We've had another round about the whole neuroscience thing, but this comes from a recent blog of his. He writes, "Intentionality is the aboutness or meaning of a mental state, the ability of a mental state to refer to something outside of itself. Ink on a paper has no meaning unless it is conferred by a mind, which wrote it or read it. Matter may have intentionality only secondarily, derived intentionality. The problem of intentionality is believed by many philosophers of the mind to be the most serious challenge to materialism. Meaning is imparted to matter by a mind. Matter isn't the source of meaning. Therefore, matter, brain tissue, can't be the entire cause of the mind."
Okay, now again, slower.
So what is the core logical fallacy of this bit of nonsense from Dr. Egnor?
Core blimey.
Well, it's a
It's
a crappy analogy. I mean, ink, comparing ink to a human brain.
Yeah, exactly. It's a false analogy. So, what's the false analogy?
Ink's not a brain.
Yeah, ink's dead matter. It's not self. It's not reflective. It can't think and assess and compute and any of that stuff.
Plus, it can't do stuff. Yeah, ink is inert, as you say. Yeah, ink is dead, inert stuff. It's not. A brain is not. A brain is living. It can use energy and transmit information.
That's such a common mistake amongst creationists, because you hear the same thing when they talk about why doesn't this rock evolve into life. They don't understand that a rock doesn't, you know, reproduce, and that's the important difference.
Yeah, but what about magic ink?
Magic ink also is inert. In fact,
right.
It's lemon juice.
Also the same fallacy they commit when they abuse the second law of thermodynamics, which is kind of what you're saying, where they say that you know things cannot go to greater order over time. Well,
right.
Living things can, you know, rocks can't, right. But something that is using energy to grow and reproduce, I mean, an acorn turns into an oak tree, that's a violation of entropy, but it's because it's a living thing that's using energy. And one of the things that life does is evolve. One of the things that a living organ like the brain does is think and feel and remember and, you know,
love.
And all the things, and have intention. But, I mean, Egnor essentially wrote an entire blog entry saying how materialism is superstitious nonsense because of this thing, because matter can't inherently have emotions or intention or subjective experience, equating essentially the brain to a lump of clay.
Which his is, actually. Little known fact.
Little known
name fact. That logical fallacy. That's right. Ad hominem. Thank you.
Hominem.
Steve, what about the part here where he says that intentionality is believed by many philosophers of the mind to be the most serious challenge to materialism? Is that a bit of an overstatement?
Yeah, you know, he's just pulling that out of his behind. Yeah, he does that a lot. I mean, he basically completely misinterprets philosophers and then tries to use them to support his statements. But he confuses philosophical arguments with scientific arguments. He does that a lot in this blog entry as well. He sort of talks on both levels at the same time and just completely swaps and confuses these arguments. At one point, he's talking about, you know, that materialism is not scientific, but then he uses completely philosophical arguments to say it that have nothing to do with how science works or how you ask scientific questions.
He's just practicing dualism, Steve. Now, don't come down on him.
Yeah. It's a complete incoherent mess in the end. But this is, he's wrong. He's just flat out wrong when he says that. He tries to he's actually also invoked philosophers to support his position who have said directly that the position he's defending is wrong and is nonsense.
Beautiful, beautiful.
He doesn't read that deeply into the people that he uses as support for his positions.
Just use it for what he needs and move along.
Move along.
Right. It's all about misdirection. And
Angor is compartmentalization personified.
Yeah, that was actually my conclusion in my blog entry responding to this, that's what he does. He totally compartmentalizes, just keeps different bits of information separate from each other.
Well, thanks for listening, Dr. Egnor, and keep on listening.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my expert skeptics to sniff out the fake. You guys are ready for this week?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, here we go. Item number one, DNA analysis of gut bacteria reveals that obese individuals are more likely to possess bacteria that allow for more efficient extraction of calories from food. Item number two, researchers find that an acidic diet leads to bone loss and osteoporosis, while an alkali diet has the opposite effect. And item number three, scientists have found that the giant pea pod plant, despite being rooted in the ground, is able to move slowly over time, eventually covering several yards. Jay, go first.
Item number one, DNA analysis of gut bacteria reveals that obese individuals are more likely to possess bacteria that allow for more efficient extraction of calories from food. That is very interesting. Something about that doesn't seem right to me. I mean, what would actually change their gut bacteria to a more efficient bacteria? I guess the untold premise here is that obese people have bacteria before they were obese. They had bacteria that was better at extracting calories from food, and that's why they're obese.
That's one interpretation.
Okay. All right. Next one. Researchers find that an acidic diet leads to bone loss and osteoporosis, while an alkaline diet has the opposite effect. Man, I have no idea. No idea about that one. And the third one, scientists have found that the giant pea pod plant, despite being rooted in the ground, is able to move slowly over time, eventually covering several yards. Well, I'm going to just say that one's true because I like it. I'm going to say that the acidic versus non-acidic diet, I'll say that one is true. So I believe that the bacteria one is false.
Okay. Evan?
Yeah, very interesting stuff, Steve. Good ones this week. I think that there being bacteria allowing for more efficient extraction of calories from food is very plausible. While the whole acidic alkali one, I don't quite understand how that could necessarily be possible. An acidic diet, like what? I'm not sure how they constitute an acidic diet versus an alkali diet, and how much of a person's diet is acidic versus alkali. I'm not sure. And then the giant pea pod plant covering several yards. Yeah, seems plausible. I'll say that the acidic versus alkali diet one is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The gut bacteria one in obese individuals, that sounds really plausible to me, that they just have strains of bacteria that are just really good at pulling out calories from food. It's interesting, though, that what if they were to swap their gut bacteria with less efficient bacteria, what would happen? Would it be a good way for them to lose weight? The second one, the acidic diet and alkali diet, I have no idea. That's total. I could just, like Jay, I don't know what the hell's going on with that. I can't make an educated guess. The giant pea pod plant rooted in the ground. So this is a giant plant that's rooted in the ground, and it's slowly moving. I'm not buying that. I'm going to say that is false.
Okay. So they're completely divided, Rebecca.
Oh,
what are you going to say?
Man, that didn't help me at all. Well, the gut bacteria, that sounds... I know I've read something like that, but the problem is that I'm pretty sure I read it ages ago, but I think it was pretty much that. So I don't know if something new came out to refute it, and that's where you're screwing around with us or what. But I'm going to go ahead and say that one's science. I'm not too sure about the acidic diet leading to bone loss and osteoporosis, although that sounds like it would be true because I can picture in my head an acid eating through bone. And that's what I have to rely upon.
And the sizzling sounds.
Is funny cartoons in my head. The idea of a giant pea pod plant moving despite being rooted in the ground, I haven't read anything about that, but I just really, I like the idea, and I hope that it's not just that they're moving, but that all the pea pod plants in the world are actually moving towards one little boy's house. Some little boy who just refused to eat his peas.
Awesome.
And
the triffids.
In the cartoon version, in my head, the pea pod plants have teeth. So I'm going to say that the acidic diet leading to bone loss is fiction.
Okay. So good. And I like when the field is divided like this, evenly divided. So we'll take them in order, I guess. First one, DNA analysis of gut bacteria reveals that obese individuals are more likely to possess bacteria that allow for more efficient extraction of calories from food. And that one is science.
Ah! Aha!
Now, yeah, this is examining the different bacteria that exist in the gastrointestinal system, the GI flora, if you will, is not new. But what they've been doing is looking specifically at the DNA. So rather than trying to identify specific species of bacteria in the gut, they just grind them up and look at the genes. So they're just looking at what bacterial genes are there in the gut. So it's just doing a DNA analysis that still gives them a way to identify different bacteria. And they found some interesting things. They found that of all the different, many different bacterial species that can occupy the intestinal system, that they share a lot of genes in common. So that there are genes common to all the different bacteria that live in our guts, which makes sense. And these are genes that enable them to digest food in ways that we can't. So they have genes that we don't. It's very complementary. I mean, they work together. And in fact, when they did twin studies, so they looked at both identical and fraternal twins, both within the same family and separated, they found that the bacteria that you have at a very young age, at basically infancy, has a dominant effect on the bacteria that you have even as an adult. So if you look at twins separated shortly after birth, but that were together for a period of time, they have very similar. They have more similar bacteria than they do with their adoptive family. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's also that it's interesting that there's a lot of differences. Everyone has their own unique sort of assortment of bacteria in their stomach, and there's a lot of variation. And they did one of the patterns that they found was that people who were obese had more genes, bacterial genes, that would enable efficient extraction of calories and other nutrients from food. This, of course, is a correlation. It doesn't tell us what's causing what. Is it that the eating habits of obese people leads to these bacteria, or does the greater efficiency of calorie extraction make them or contribute to their obesity?
I think the latter. I think it's the latter, Steve. Since you said at an early age, you're pretty much set for life anyway. So
yeah, that's true. That would tend to support the latter one, which is what the leading hypothesis is. And as what I think Jay asked, well, could we change the bacteria in the gut?
I did.
And, oh, was that your question? Yeah, could we change the bacteria in the gut and help people lose weight that way?
Right.
By being inefficient at getting calories out of food. That's very interesting. So I do think we are entering, or we're seeing the very beginnings of what in the future will be a new way of intervening in health and illness,
and absolutely
by just manipulating the intestinal flora, the bacteria.
Oh, and, you know, if we could give obese people less efficient bacteria, could we give people in developing countries more efficient bacteria?
Oh, yeah,
help nutrition.
Yeah. Absolutely. Or engineer
cool.
bacteria to do whatever we want. You know, that's where it's going to get interesting. You know,
isn't this also another reason not indiscriminately using antibiotics, because you don't want to be killing all your intestinal bacteria.
Yeah.
Because of the medicine you're taking, and who knows what's going to take its place.
That's right. And in fact, they excluded people from this study who had antibiotics in the last 6 months, because that does dramatically change your intestinal flora. Do you guys know, this is interesting, I don't know if we talked about this, that once people decimate their bacterial, their GI bacteria with like a long course of broad spectrum antibiotics, mm-hmm. sometimes it's really hard, to get for the bacteria to grow back. Eating yogurt like with probiotics,
yeah.
It doesn't really do much because you're getting one species. You're trying to replace Mark Crislip, characterized that as cutting down a rainforest and then planting rows of corn. Doesn't quite do it. Giving one species back is not enough. You need a variety. So they're actually looking into doing fecal transplants.
Ew.
What?
Ew. So you poop before you take the antibiotics, and then they'll take the germs, the bacteria from your poop, and stick it back in your stomach.
Yeah, or they take it from a family member.
But they're dead.
Ew.
Aren't they dead when you're...
House?
No. That's why you can get infections from feces. It's very unclear.
Yeah, there's tons of bacteria in poop. Bob, stop touching poop. It's covered in bacteria.
A large chunk of
poop.
It's mostly
dead bacteria, but there's still a lot of live bacteria in there too.
All right, I didn't realize it was that much that were alive that could repopulate your intestines. I realized that it's like the vast majority of it is dead bacteria.
Bob, you don't know shit.
I'm so glad we worked both pee and poop into this podcast.
Yeah,
very earthy podcast. Yeah. Yes,
this is the best podcast of the year.
Let's go on to number two.
Number two,
acidic diet leads to bone loss.
Good.
And osteoporosis, while an alkali diet has the opposite effect, and that one is
poop.
Also, science.
Wow. Yeah. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of like alkali acidic diet pseudoscience out there. So I thought I might catch some of you guys on that from that angle. But this is legitimate, and the effect is only significant in older people. What makes this work is why all of the pseudoscientific, pH diets are pseudoscience. You can't actually, short of poisoning, you can't really affect the pH of your blood or your tissues by what you eat. That's because there's elaborate systems, physiological metabolic systems to keep your pH in a very narrow range. But if you have a very acidic diet, what happens is in older people who cells are, they're not as healthy, they're not as able to compensate for that. So what they have to do is actually leach calcium phosphates out of the bone in order to balance the pH. So their pH does stay balanced, but at the expense of calcium in the bones.
Hmm.
So if you have a very acidic diet, meaning that it contains a lot of proteins and carbohydrates, then that can actually increase bone loss. And if you have an alkali diet, then that shifts calcium back into the bones. So that's the opposite effect.
Well, what would an alkali diet be?
Lots of fruits and vegetables.
Oh.
Right.
I couldn't think of anything besides protein and carbohydrates.
Yeah. So if you eat lots of fruits and vegetables when you're older, it may help your bone health, may help fight off osteoporosis.
That means the pea pod plants aren't for real.
Yeah. So that means number three, scientists have found that the giant pea pod plant, despite being rooted in the ground, is able to move slowly over time, eventually covering several yards, is fiction.
What are parents going to tell their kids when they won't eat their peas? Eat them all or the pea pod plants will get you.
But this is another week where I read the headline and misinterpreted it. And then when I read the body of this article, I'm like, oh, they're not talking about this at all. But I kept my misinterpretation as the fake. So here's the title of the press release. Rooted plants move mysteriously down greenways, scientists say. I'm like, really? Rooted plants are moving? But they're just talking about the spread of seeds. I know. And it is the pea pod plant. The question is, so there, some plants have strategies for spreading their seeds, either by having animals eat fruit or having it be very lightweight and being spread by the wind or having spurs that will attach to animals' fur. But there are other plants that just drop their seeds and don't really have any mechanism for spreading them. Among them, the pea pod plant. But what they found was, despite a lack of any known mechanism for spreading seeds, these plants do tend to spread their offspring, you know, through seeds into these sort of preferred greenways or corridors.
So maybe they're secretly moving. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they don't. It's an anomaly. They don't know how it's spreading in these preferred directions down green corridors.
Okay, so eat your peas, or the pea pod plants will spread in our direction.
Right.
It's not quite
right.
as scary, but yeah.
No, it's not quite as scary. But you do have to, you know, the image of the triffids, of course, immediately comes to mind when you think of plants with roots sort of crawling across the ground.
The triffids?
Triffids, yeah. Day of the
What's
Triffids.
A what?
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes? What?
Day of the Triffids. Look it up.
The Day
What's
of the
Day
Triffids?
Day of the Triffids?
Yeah, the plants from space that kill people, and they figured out that seawater dissolves them. That was
oh,
nice.
Well, way to ruin it for me, jerk.
Oh, you didn't. How old's that story?
Don't you love it when people ask you if you've heard a joke and they identify it by the punchline?
No.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, Bob. Good job.
Good.
Thank
good
you.
Good job. Yep.
Good job.
Thank
Bob.
You.
This
yeah. Way to go,
one.
Bob.
Tap tap.
If it couldn't be me, I'm glad it was you.
Jay, please give us a quote.
This is a quote by one of my favorite people in the podcasting universe, Mark Krislip. Yeah. This is a quote sent in by a listener named Johan Lans from Stockholm, Sweden. And the quote is...
It's probably Johan. I'm just guessing.
Johan Lans.
Yes, Johan.
Johan Lans.
And by the way, the podcast is Quackcast, and Mark also contributes weekly to science-based medicine.
Thank you, Mark. And Mark said, "Instead of calling it worthless Chinese energy piece of crap, I'm going to keep it simple and call it qi. Live with it." Mark Krislip!
So that's his shorthand for worthless energy piece of whatever. Mark's a very wry and pithy guy.
Yeah, I love his.
I love
his.
You gotta love
him. Crackcast. It's
Mark's
awesome.
Great.
He needs
I
to
have
come
a
out
thing.
With him on a more regular basis.
I have a
you
thing.
Have
Rebecca,
a thing?
What's your thing?
Go get it checked
I
out.
I have a Boston Skeptics in the pub.
I have
That's
launches.
Right. Another oh. plug. I'll be having a Boston Skeptics in the pub kind of early this month, Saturday, December 13th, and then also. I'm going to be giving a talk at UK London Skeptics in the Pub in January 19th.
You're flying all the way across the pond to the UK, burning fuel all the way?
All the way, but it's not a pleasure trip. That's a lie. It's actually a pleasure trip.
It's pure hedonism.
There's going to be a lot of nudity, I won't lie. Sid Rodriguez of London Skeptics in the Pub has booked me to give a talk there. So
awesome.
That's January 19th.
Plus, Rebecca, I understand that the Skeptics have produced their own podcast. Tell us
Holy
about
crap,
that.
We have. I'm so glad you asked. We're just getting started, so we're a little rough right now, much like the SGU in its infancy. So yeah, right now we've got two episodes up. We just published our second one, and it's a 2008 Skeptic Gift Guide for the Geek in Your Life.
More skeptical goodness.
Steve, what do we have coming up?
The last show in December will be the 2008 wrap-up episode. As we've mentioned on the message board, send us your recommendations for the whatever you want us to talk about. That was the coolest, best, funniest thing about 2008, the best science news item, the best quote from one of us, the best interview, whatever, the best bit, just whatever it is. Send that in to
Who's
us.
Who's the douchebag of the year?
Right.
Yeah.
Who's the month? Yeah.
The gullible douchebag of the year. Send it all in. Yep. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptic.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.